This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Good day, greetings, hello, and welcome to Art at the End of the World, the podcast where we welcome artists, entertainers, and cultural leaders speaking about what it is to make art here at the end. And you're with the Zoomer Podcast Network. My name is Mark Wigmore, host of The Oasis on the New Classical FM in Toronto, and welcome to a special New Classical FM focused edition of the program. And this is a podcast about artistry and the history of artists. And through long form conversations, we get into their reflections on how they make art and their experiences and their life, but also thoughts on our evolving or, dare I say, devolving culture. Great to be with you. We have a wonderful episode planned, and this episode is sponsored by Crow's Theatre, one of the country's most acclaimed arts organizations and based in Toronto's vibrant East End community. Crow's Theatre, creating unforgettable theatre that examines and illuminates the pivotal narratives of our times. Crowstheatre.com for info and tickets. Go and enjoy a show at Crow's at Carlaw and Dundas, and you can currently see Carly Street in Grounded at the theatre running through this weekend. Also, thank you to Red Eye Media, a leading arts and entertainment communications company working with award-winning clients, including the musical stage company, Summerworks Performance Festival, and many others. RedEyeMedia.ca for further info. Well, we're over the hump. The first five episodes of season two are in the books, and we have re-released five episodes in our remix series, all available to you at classicalfm.ca, artattheendoftheworld.com, and of course you can subscribe. That's what we would prefer you to do at iTunes and Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and all the other apps and places. Please subscribe and download our conversations with classical superstar Alexandra Streliski, nominated for three Junos in a couple weeks, filmmaker Robert Lantos, who just picked up a record-setting amount of Canadian Screen Award nominations for his film, The Song of Names. Very exciting. Theater heavyweights Wayne Mangesha and Chris Abraham, and documentarian Alan Zweig was last week. Just search for Art at the End of the World for all those conversations. Today's guest is someone hopefully you'll be very familiar with if you listen to the New Classical FM. Marilyn Lightstone, the host of Nocturne, which you can hear every evening on the radio station. But of course, so many people know her as an actress over the years on film, television, on stage all across this country, certainly in the early part of her career, and then into film and television features like Lies My Father Told Me, In Praise of Older Women, speaking of Robert Lantos, and her voice work in the cult classic animated feature Heavy Metal. Did you see that one? Great. And I can remember Marilyn's voice in that particular film. Her TV shows, Anne of Green Gables, Road to Avonlea, The Littlest Hobo, Titans, and The King of Kensington. And she's currently still on TV on Vision TV with a program, a music program titled Your All-Time Classic Hit Parade, which is in its third season and going into its fourth. Marilyn has a beautiful voice. It is a great gift. She was the voice of the Bravo Network for a long, long time. I remember listening to her there. She's the voice of the New Classical FM. Even going back into my childhood, I think of her voicing in Heathcliff and GoBots, and she voiced numerous animated shows over the years. She wrote a book as well titled Rogues and Vagabonds. She's a photographer, visual artist, singer, kind of just the whole package. Really has spent a lot of time in show business and the arts, and her delivery and presence, very specific. She is a real pro. For me, over this last year, I feel very fortunate. I've had a chance to get to know Marilyn and just love talking to her. She's just such a resource, always very upbeat, and has, at the same time, very strong opinions about art and culture and politics. So let's get to it. My talk with Marilyn Lightstone on Art at the End of the World.
Thank you.
I think I've told you this before, but Marilyn is my mother's name as well.
No, you didn't tell me that before.
So there's only been a few Marilyns in my life.
In your life.
And you're one of them.
Okay. By
the way, studying up on you was a very pleasurable experience, I have to say.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
Just going through your career and going through all your different, all the different avenues of your career and all the different parts you played and everything. It's.
I'm glad you're glad.
I had so much fun doing it. It was like, oh my gosh, all the movies and TV shows.
I feel the same way too. It's been fun.
Has it been fun?
Oh yeah, it has.
You
been
look
fun.
Back at it fondly.
I do very much.
Yeah. No bad feelings about the dirty old entertainment business.
Well, not about the entertainment business, but there are things
show
that,
business.
There are things that irk me, but I that's the way they are, and that's what it is, and that's what show business is, and you know, I'm not going to spend too much energy.
That's how you really feel.
It. Well, there's no point. No point in expressing your displeasures, I've discovered.
Right.
So, you know, how did you learn that lesson? Well, experience, just, you know, you say how terrible your things are. Nobody pays any attention. So we really kind of shut up and just get on with it.
That is productive. True, right?
Well, energy is energy, you know, it just can be converted into so many things. And if you have the choice between converting it into something that you enjoy or spending it complaining and bitching, I mean, knowing that there's very little going to be done about it, you know, that's the choice I've made.
Knowing you the little bit that I do over this last year, I honestly believe that. I believe that down to the base of your soul, that you're a person who can let go of things and...
Well, you have to.
And enjoy your life. And
as long as there are other things, you know, in the future to look forward to and that there's progress and forward movement.
Right.
And you're not left to stew. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people. Sort of nothing else is happening. So they remain mired in their past. And,
right.
You know, what's the point?
It's such an interesting thing because there are certainly, I'm sure you have examples too of people in your life who that's the badge they walk around with.
Yes. And I really feel for them too. And you try to, you know, when you meet people like that, You try to think that you have some influence, you know, getting things moving forward. But very often, people who are who they are, and change is a very difficult thing. You know, it's difficult to do for yourself, and it's certainly practically impossible to do for somebody else.
What was the toughest moment of change for you in your life where you had to make a very difficult decision about where you were headed?
Oh, gosh.
We've all had a few of those moments, right, where there was
usually
fork in the road.
It happens when you feel, well, I've on a particular road in a certain avenue, and then it's suddenly drying up. You know, it's kind of the road's coming to an end, and when what do you do next? There's a moment of panic until you kind of realize there are other things that you do want to do. Because being left without something that you really want to do, I guess that a general thing for me is that I have to have a project that I love, something in which I can direct my energies and my attention to.
I mean, I've been in that situation too. And if you like making things and creating things,
mm-hmm.
that's not altogether that hard to do.
Making it, but the thing is, you know, for example, if you're in the theater, for example,
yeah.
you can't act in isolation. You can say, I'm an actress. And incidentally, I use the term actress just in case you call me an actor.
You do.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Why do you? Boy,
because,
we were opening up so many jars here.
Because the history of the actress, the female person on the stage, is so completely different from that of men. And if we change the name, we lose all of that history. And that's what happens when we change words into other words that are supposed to be neutral and neither, you know, not masculine or feminine.
Right.
We lose the nuance. And, well, the role of women, you know, we first think of Shakespeare, for example, you know, young boys played women's roles. And any woman that dared to be on the stage, finally, when they were permitted to be on the stage, was really thought to be no better, you know, than a harlot, a
right.
prostitute,
right.
You know, a woman of loose morals. And that it really is not as an idea that you might think. I'd say even when I began thinking about my future life when I was in school, I think that idea was still prevalent that unless you were lucky and became a big movie star, that, you know, it wasn't quite respectable
right.
to be an actress.
Even some of the roles, too. I mean, I think about, I just happened to be watching TCM last night and Marilyn Monroe
mm-hmm.
starring in this sort of strange cowboy movie. And I don't remember what the title was, but I did look at her character. It was, you know, she was sort of helpless and there was this mental illness element seemed to be happening and completely being led around by the men, it left me thinking, gosh, we sure had women in a certain place for a very long time.
We couldn't vote.
Movies.
We couldn't vote. You needed your when I first began, you know, life as an independent person after finishing my training and moving to Toronto, I didn't have a credit rating.
Right.
If you wanted to buy anything, you needed your husband's signature, mm-hmm. you know, to get a credit card, or your father's. You needed some kind of a male personage to vouch for you. I mean, the tremendous changes, you know, within my lifetime, which is getting increasingly longer by the moment. So I've seen a lot of changes, but that very much was the idea that women are, you know, not really capable. Not capable and have to be protected and cosseted. And because they were incapable, they were also made them inferior. Anyway, that's the whole business of, you know, women's empowerment is a great big sidetrack.
The impetus for that bit of conversation was actress. So we don't forget that title for those reasons anymore.
Yes. And I remember once many years ago when this first came into being, this idea that we all had to adopt this new name, and my objecting to it. And I had an interview with someone from one of the Toronto newspapers. And again, this subject came up because I referred myself as an actress and was called on it. And I explained it and I said, she's, would you rather I changed it? I said, yes, please change it to actress. That's what I want to be called. She says, well, I'll change it, but my editor probably won't let it through. And that's really what happens. So even though you specifically ask her something, I mean, talk about lack of women's empowerment, the fact that I want to become an actress and I cannot be called an actress.
Right.
Because, and the thing is too, people assume that if you change the word, you change the attitude. And my idea is change the attitude. The word is perfectly fine. It's the attitude that needs addressing. And changing the word does not necessarily change the attitude.
Robert Lantos was on the program recently. You know Robert.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a little bit about where we are in the modern award system, and not so much about actor and actress, but someone had approached him and said that women directors actually need their own category at the Oscars. Because they've been so excluded from the conversation.
Well, isn't that a kind of sexism on its own? I mean,
that's what he thought.
I think so too, actually.
Right.
The idea is that if you direct, you're a director.
Right.
You're not a female director, a male director.
But if you're an actor, you're an actor or an actress.
Well, just because it's my history.
Right.
My personal history. The history of the American director is still, you know, or rather female director, I meant to say, is still kind of developing.
It is.
Really. It's a new phenomenon, whereas the profession of actress, you know, goes back hundreds of years.
So Montreal.
Yep.
That's where it begins. And I often try to remember this, that Montreal was the heart of this country.
It's special.
and it really, but it really was. That's where the banks were. That's where everything was happening until late 60s and everything changes and suddenly we're all here in Toronto. But what was that upbringing for you? What was that?
Well, you know, when you're born in a place, you really take it very much for granted. But it was a very pleasurable place to grow up. Although, you know, now that I know some of its history, I realize that there was a tremendous amount of, you know, political pressure and inequality and bias and anti-Semitism and all the usual nasty things you find in any big city turned up in Montreal.
Right.
But Montreal also has a laissez-faire, you know, kind of a charm, a kind of let's party, let's have a good time. And the mixture of peoples, too, I think, in Montreal was very interesting to me because even well, during the war, just after the war, before the huge flux of immigration happened in Montreal, we still lived on a street that was so varied, you know, kind of French Canadians and Europeans and Anglos and WASPs and Jewish people, you know, all mixed up together and the Irish. And that wasn't true for every neighborhood in Montreal, but I lived quite close to St. Lawrence Boulevard, the famous Main, just one block over, and it had a texture and a richness and a wonderful smells. And
that's a happy memory for you.
It is. No, I think Montreal was a great place to grow up in. I'm very, very glad. I'm always glad to go back and visit. I have no desire to live there, you know, permanently for the same reasons as the reasons for which I left Montreal. It's not that I wanted to leave the city. It's just that I was going to be an actress. And if you wanted to work in the English language, the province of Quebec wasn't the place to do it. The city was here in Toronto.
That's why I left Victoria, BC, too.
That's
if I want to be in this business in a larger capacity.
That's right. If you want to make cars, you know, you go live in what, well.
Yeah, you used to go live in Detroit.
It used to be Detroit.
But, who knows where it is.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I loved it. I had a I have good memories of Montreal.
What was the family situation? Siblings and all that?
I've got two younger siblings, two younger brothers.
Okay.
One is 4.5 years younger than I, and who is a grandfather and a terrific guy, and then a fellow who used to work at City TV in the old days.
Okay.
He was the youngest member of the staff. He was a cameraman at the time, and
okay.
He now lives in British Columbia. And he's 14 and a half years younger than I am, so I'm kind of half his mom and half his, you know, his big sister.
Yeah, right. That happens,
yeah.
Right? And then when there's this late in the game kids that come along. And I think it was in the film Lies My Father Told Me that you said there were some parallels there to your own upbringing. Is that, have I got the right film there?
Well, yeah, I think so. There was this family situation in which the husband really was in conflict with the father, you know, of my father.
Yeah.
And I lived in a situation like that. We lived with my grandmother, and it wasn't the easiest situation. And also just kind of financially in terms of the neighborhood, you know, where we were shooting that movie, it was where I grew up. And I remember one day we were going on to look at a house in the film, to see an empty house. And it was a street over from where I grew up. And, you know, it just reminded me of all the houses that I saw when I'd visit my friends, you know, after school. Kind of Montreal flats, cold water flats.
Right.
With the outside staircases. Whatever conflicts there were in our household, I was supported and loved and cosseted.
Right.
And always supported, too. And this is the thing that I kind of assumed that all the other girls that I went to school with had family situations like mine, in which whatever they wanted to do would be supported by their parents, and they would be encouraged. But it turns out that was not the case. And I only found out as an adult that all these young women who I thought really had a much more materially advantageous life than I had, because it was always a struggle in our family,
right,
you know, just to get along and get through. But somehow their parents didn't give them that unqualified support. And it kind of shocked me. I thought, well, surely, you know, especially every little girl, you know, who paints or wants to dance or wants to write or would be encouraged. But that was not the case. And in the case of my family, who were not well educated, they were not sophisticated, but somehow they trusted me and they supported me. Whatever I wanted to do was going to be, you know, just fine with them.
Which, like you say, going back to the beginning of this conversation, when you were talking about moving to Toronto and, you know, needing the husband to sign the checks and
uh-huh.
all the rest of it, you know, it was a different time. And it was, you uh-huh. know, not necessarily,
very
you know,
much.
It was deemed that the daughter shall do this, and that is the respectable thing to do, and these are the respectable jobs, and so on. So you can totally see how that happened, but it is
yes.
unique.
This was a time, too, remember, Mark, in which, if there were three kids in a family that was financially constrained,
mm-hmm.
the boys would be educated and the girls wouldn't be.
Right.
That's, you know, how close this still is. Now, admittedly, I'm getting on in years, so when I look back at, you know, at my youth, it's some time ago, but still, the boys would go to school, they'd go to university, but the girls would become typists and receptionists and stenographers, and if they were lucky, secretaries, or maybe a nurse.
Right.
That was my first ambition, actually, as my aunt was a nurse in the Canadian Army during the war.
I think Bill Burr put it very well when he said, you know, the writing of the Constitution wasn't that long ago. That's like three people ago when you
yes.
actually stack them up.
Yes.
You know, it isn't that long ago.
Yes, it isn't.
You were supported
mm-hmm.
with these ideas. And what were some of those early ideas?
Well, all the things that I love to do now are the things I love to do then.
I love
and
it.
I'm just going to tell you, you know, I love to read, I love to write, and I love to paint, and I like to act and put on plays with my friends. And
was there a person in your life who sort of showed you the way to
not really
to accomplish
this? It's just I wanted to do that, and as I say, my parents gave me free rein. They never said no, you should be doing this, that, or the other. They always were very pleased. And well, you see, I was a good kid. I wasn't a problem kid that they had to control.
Right.
I did well at school, and I didn't fight with, you know, with my friends or my family, and I was well behaved. But no one ever said to me, no, you can't do that, or you mustn't do that, or you shouldn't do that, or whatever. I just was allowed to be who I wanted to be.
Did you actually go in and experience theater and go and
No, that was another irony, because we were so financially constrained, it cost money to go to the theater.
Of course.
So occasionally went to the movies when you could get in, because in Montreal at the time there was a law that unless you were 16 years old, you couldn't go to a movie. unless it was a special kids feature, because there'd been a fire in a movie theater in Montreal somewhere in the 30s,
okay,
in which I think there'd been some loss of life. So from that time on, kids were not allowed into the movies. So what we would have to do, if you wanted to go, you know, you're 13 or 14, you dressed up in your mom's coat and you put on lots of lipstick. I mean, I'm going to think of it now. I'm sure we looked every bit as young as we were. The lipstick didn't make any difference.
Standing on some
and
other
exactly,
kid's shoulders.
You know, your mother's hid clothes and her coat and everything and go and pretend to be 16 years old.
Right. Put on the lipstick, put on the makeup,
yes,
do whatever you can.
Yes, I'm sure we fooled no one, but somehow we got into the movies.
Yeah,
but in terms of theater and tickets, and all, there was no money for any of that. They really was financially constrained.
What did Dad do?
My dad was a printer by trade.
Okay.
And sometimes he was able to practice his profession. Other times he wasn't. But he just turned his hand to whatever he could do. He painted houses. He made pizzas, you know, kind of in fairs. He really turned his hand to whatever he could do, and not a lazy guy, but not really a business person, not a business head. He wasn't someone who's going to establish a business and work it in a business-like way. He
right.
didn't have that kind of mentality.
Yeah.
In fact, I think probably he liked to do things with his hands too. He liked to make things.
Yeah. I sometimes lust after that life, I must say.
You know, making things?
Yeah, once in a while I get out there with an axe and a pretty blunt instrument, but start cutting some firewood, and I do feel like maybe this would have been better.
The simple life?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I regret so much is that during my moves, when I was a grown-up person and I'd be living out of town, maybe my parents were keeping some things for me, mm-hmm. they moved house, and some of the things that never turned up afterwards was my McGill blazer, my duffel coat, my Fry cowboy boots, and a photograph album that my father had made for me, actually compiled for me, because he was a printer and he was used to putting things together.
Sure.
And it had all my teenage photographs, all my high school photographs, and on the skating rink, you know, and doing sports at school and everything, gone. I'd pay a lot of money, really, if that turned up kind of on my doorstep. And
only in your memory
rent,
now.
So only in my memory. But I remember my dad, who wasn't very good about buying me presents, but he made me presents.
Right.
He made me presents. And this book had my initial on in sort of leatherette. But he'd done it with his own two hands. He made this book for me.
I can't name 19 out of the last 20 presents that were given to me. But the one he made for you, you can remember very well.
I remember. And the fact that I don't have it caused me great sorrow.
Yeah.
So anyone out there, if you know where it is, turn it up. There'll be a huge reward,
I promise.
No, really, I'd pay a lot to get that.
Fair enough.
To have that book.
Okay. If somebody's got it in a dusty box somewhere, yeah, that would be a thing to find. So you're not that aware of the theater out there, but you are
not at all
compelled to act and compelled to put on skits and sketches and
and have stories.
I liked doing that too. I like putting on magic shows.
Oh well, that takes a degree of skill. You see that I didn't have.
I had no skill. I remember actually telling everybody to turn around so that I could do the trick.
I think my brother had a magic kit. There were kits, I think, that
there
kids
were.
Could buy, weren't they?
Yeah, and I remember.
At the back of comic books, there were little things where you could send in for them.
That's right. I think my mom actually got me a little box of magic, and I wasn't that good at it. So I would have to tell people, okay, just turn around for a sec. And then, you know. But I love that, and I love kids getting creative. I remember putting on little radio shows, too, and so on. So perhaps that's where things were headed. What was the step to say, okay,
Well, I
want to actually take this a little further.
Of course, you know, there were very few theaters, certainly English-speaking theaters in Montreal. There was a summer theater called Mountain Playhouse, which was on the top of Mount Royal, I believe. And there may have been one or two summer stock things, but there wasn't a real English-speaking theater. It was only a theater called Her or His Majesty's, depending who was on the throne, that was a roadhouse for stuff from the United States or from Britain. But other than that, there was very little to be seen. I hadn't seen many plays, but I got to university and thinking, well, what am I going to do with my life? There was nowhere to train to be in the theater at all.
And you were in university in Montreal.
In Montreal, I went to McGill.
Yep.
I got involved in student theater because before that I thought, well, what am I going to do with myself? Maybe my days of being a lawyer had to do with what I saw on television, that you got a chance to stand up in court and make wonderful speeches, a la Perry Mason, but I know now, of course, that being a lawyer is really not at all like that.
Sure isn't.
No, it isn't. It's very hard work. And
my lawyer friends, it's not that glamorous.
No, it's really tough.
Yeah.
So I had no clue. I had a romanticized audition of what that would be. And I started doing theater at McGill. And there was a group called the Red and White Review, which was a student-written, both music and you know, and text every year that was put on. A lot of people actually worked for the Red and White Review, you know, went on to become professional performers. The dean of arts at the time was Dean Fieldhouse. We called him Dean Fieldmouse. And his idea was that there was no place for the study of theater in academia for acting. At the time, those of us who loved to act and, you know, be in shows thought that was terrible. But, you know, I've come to the conclusion he was right, because acting is not an academic subject. I think academia should be restricted to people who are in academic subjects. And I found that when I went to theater school after McGill University, I really had to unlearn all the things, all the ways you approach a subject in terms of studying it, you know, as a, you know, a book, a text, or whatever that you're going to write. And it's very different from what you have to do.
There's still a way to study it, but it's just a different part of your brain.
You have to be, you know, you have to, the whole idea of improvising, you know, is very important in the theater and acting, and it has no place in academia, I don't think.
Right.
That really kind of gave me the bug, but still there was no place to study. And I thought, well, all the people who wanted to be actors, you know, people like, you know, Christopher Plummer and whatnot, who were also from Montreal, they either went to London or to New York to study or to work. And I couldn't afford to go to New York or to London, because I, you know, I'd managed to sort of scrape up enough funds between me, you know, my dad helping me a little and kind of working at a bunch of jobs to get through university.
What were some of the little jobs? This is always interesting to me.
Oh, kind of. When I was in high school, well, I loved to paint. I loved doing visual arts is very much a part of my thing, too.
Of course,
I get the itch, you know, a couple of times a year in which I have to do it. So my high school art teacher.
By the way, beautiful photographs. Everything I've looked at that you've shot are so gorgeous.
Thank you, Mark.
And I know you're very passionate
about it. Yeah, I really am. Just every now and then I have to make something physically with my hands, you know, with a paintbrush, with whatever. So there was in high school, and when I was 14, my art teacher, her name was Leah Sherman, and she went on actually to help start the art program at Concordia University.
Okay.
She was the head there. But I was kind of her pet. Not that she, you know, behaved in that way, but she was tremendously supportive of what I was doing in her class. And she wanted me to go to University of Michigan, where she studied fine arts, to get a master in fine arts. But I, you know, I really wasn't sure. I wanted a general education. And I had no means anyway to go and study anywhere outside of
Abroad.
Montreal.
Abroad, yes.
No,
sure.
Not at all. So she got me a job with her brother-in-law, whose name was Avi Morrow. And who was very interested in the arts, a very interesting man who just died this past year. And I worked there on weekends and holidays, and I was the filing clerk, basically, down in an area in Montreal, which is now old Montreal and all very chic, but at the time was an old factory district. And they made cleaning, industrial cleaning products, this company, Avmore Limited. Avi Morrow, that was his name, my boss. And I worked there every holiday, every Easter, every Christmas, every summer for years and years
Office
and years.
Office job.
Really.
Yeah.
And what was
not
so
bad for a young person.
No, it was great. And everyone was very kind to me.
I worked a lot of like dishwashing jobs.
Oh, never.
Like,
no, I had to, never had to do
and
that.
All that kind of stuff.
But so, you know, it was so nice. I mean, when I was going to Montreal to have a costume fitting for In Praise of Older Women, talking about Robert Lantos, his film.
Yeah.
One of his first films.
Very successful film.
Yes, it was, and a very controversial film as well.
Film. Yes. And you were in it.
And I was in it.
Yeah.
So our costume fitting was to be in Old Montreal, and there I was. And I thought, I wonder if Avmore Limited is still there and is open, if there's anyone there I still remember. So I walked over to it, and Mr. Moore was not there. Mr. Chinks's partner had long since died. But there was a young woman who was just taken on, a member of their family, who had just started when I was kind of making my way out of that situation. And she was there, and she greeted me very warmly. She says, come here, I have something to show you. So she takes me through this labyrinth of rooms, you know, on the main floor of the offices, and takes me into a place, and there's a painting on the wall that I'd painted in high school.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I can't remember ever giving that to them. Maybe Leah Sherman, you know, the sister-in-law of Abby, But there was one of my paintings.
That's almost a surreal moment where you weren't not even sure you could identify your own painting. Because
I recognized it, but I didn't remember ever giving it to him.
Right.
And then she said, and she took it off the wall and turned it around so I could see the back. And there, tucked into the back of the frame, were various clippings of various performances
of
that I'd done that they save and they put it back there. I was so touched.
That is unbelievable. That is a sweet story.
Yeah, and when I performed in Montreal, I'd get flowers and whatever.
Oh gosh, that's
have lunch. It was good.
Pretty nice. So filing office, and that sort of took you through and.
Yeah. And then I was a summer camp counselor. I was a drama counselor in summer camp.
Okay, so using some skills.
Yeah. And that was kind of fun, you know, doing performances of the Mikado and HMS Pinafore and whatnot.
Right, with the kids.
With these kids.
How old would the kids be?
They'd be 11, 12,
right.
Maybe 13.
And you were like, what, 18, 19, 20?
Yeah.
I did that.
Yeah, fun, isn't it?
It's really fun.
Yeah.
I had a good time doing it. I did it for like sort of a period where it's like a sweet spot to do it, and then it gets to a point, it's like, okay.
Yes. Yes, no. Only a few years, and then, you know, you've been there, done that.
Yeah,
got to move on.
So those are the jobs that take you through, and meanwhile, you're trying to find this next level of training for your acting career.
Well, luckily, during the last year of university, the National Theatre School opened in Montreal.
Right.
Now, talk about coincidence, untiming, because if it hadn't, I don't know what would have happened to me, quite frankly, because as I said, I couldn't afford to go to London or New York. So there I was at the theater school and able to live at home. I didn't even have to, to pay expenses for room and board. I was able to live at home as I had been during university. I didn't leave my parents' home until I was 24 years old.
Now,
which is unusual.
Unusual for then.
For then, but also.
Not that unusual
but
anymore.
You see, but so easy for me because my parents were so open and understanding. And I had my bedroom drawer, my dad put up, we had apartment 6 on Queen Mary Road in Montreal. And my dad put 6A on my bedroom doors. Mine was apartment 6A. And I had privacy. As I say, my parents were not sophisticated or worldly people, but they had such a intuitive understanding of how to let me be and just let me be myself. Now, you see, the thing is, too, my parents were Canadian-born parents.
Right.
And like many of the people I went to school with who were either immigrants themselves or they were the children of immigrants, I was the daughter of Canadian-born parents. And even my grandparents really had come over as small children. So I did not grow up in a situation where I had to endure all the pressures,
you know,
that happen really in families like that, where really they have to prove themselves, they have to cement their situation.
It makes a pretty huge difference, even just to have that one generation that's, been there.
Very, very, very different.
Yeah. So National Theatre School happens. In fact, Chris Abraham, who was just on the podcast from Crow's Theatre across town, I'm pretty sure that's where he went as well. A really good experience, I would take it.
Well, it was. Not perfect.
Right, of course.
Not perfect.
It was also new.
Also very new, and all the people running it were sort of new at running it. They weren't people experienced at running theatre schools. But no, for me, it was a very positive experience.
What was the jump where you thought, okay, I'm going to start to take some roles and audition? And
well, it's just once you, once you finish school, that's the idea.
That was it.
That was it. So it came to Toronto, and I had, I'd say, a very positive early experiences. I did a lot of radio drama, and I still like working in a radio studio and working with a microphone.
Slaving over a hot microphone?
Over a hot microphone.
Yeah.
And they did a lot of radio drama at the CBC in the old days.
Of course.
And sometimes with like a full orchestra, like with live musicians, things which cost-wise would never be considered now at all. But
late 60s, mid-60s?
We're talking mid-60s to late 60s.
So we're sort of in Toronto the good. I think of you as being right at the heart of the 60s cultural changes, but this city wasn't totally a part of that. I mean, I guess there were pockets of it that were experiencing all the cultural change. I don't know how connected you were with everything that was going on.
I was so busy just living my life. Right. I don't know if I paid any attention to trends or what have you. I just wanted to stay alive.
You weren't. Were you hanging out in the coffee houses seeing?
No,
the,
I wasn't.
Singer songwriters.
No, I wasn't a singer songwriter then. I was really. I was an actress, and one of my really
hanging out with the actors. Yeah, yeah.
Well, one of my favorite experiences was the Crest Theatre Hour Company. I don't know if you've ever heard about that, but there were a lot of actors at the time who were part of this company. The Crest Theatre was a repertory company.
Yeah, of course.
Founded by the Davis family here in Toronto.
Yeah.
And they had somehow gotten involved in a relationship with the school board whereby they would send out a troupe of actors for 6 months to tour all through the province of Ontario, the tiniest little towns, you know, as far north as the road would take you and as far to the border.
Good experience for any artist, I
250
think.
Schools in 6 months, high schools.
Yeah.
So that was one of my experiences, the early, early ones. And I've been in every small town in Ontario.
It's funny because they send classical musicians to do
those little tours. Yes, they do. But this was still early days,
you know,
just finding arts councils and finding funds to do that. But we were able to do that because of the school board. It was great fun. I mean, we went to places where the road ended, for example, in Manitouwadge, which is a mining town in northern, and the road just ended there. You couldn't go any further north. And we'd get off the bus, and they'd send a piper, you know, to pipe us off our bus. And then if we had to stay overnight, we would stay, you know, with a local family, and everybody in town would come to the performance because television, you know, the CBC didn't get that far north in Ontario at the time. I mean, this is a long time ago.
Right, yeah. So the circus was in town.
And everybody was involved, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Was that Shakespeare, or what was it? It was
based on the curriculum, the high school curriculum of the year. So there'd be kind of sketches.
Right.
There'd be sketches and poems and little songs. And Harry Summers at the time was dating Barbara Chilcott, whose family really produced this affair. Yeah. And he composed some music for us, you know, kind of. Everything seemed to be a little less formal than it is now. Everything is all very constructed and kind of laid out in a way. There's kind of like a floor plan or what that you have to follow. So, but I think things were a lot looser then, very loosey-goosey, because there was never any money, there weren't the right people, it wasn't involved kind of last minute. A spirit of improvisation.
Right.
I think. Nothing had established itself. You know, all these wonderful little theaters that are around, you know, now didn't exist. They didn't have a chance. And the only things that could sort of survive were things that had kind of Canada Council funding, and they were kind of a bit stodgier, but they paved the way. They served their purpose.
So you have this great experience traveling around Ontario, and you're living in Toronto, and you're hanging out with actors, and you're very much entrenched in the theater scene. And were you thinking, this is it, this is the life?
Well, this is the life
I wanted.
And then I got to go to Stratford. So that was, you know, very shortly after that, I went to Stratford and spent a couple of years there. And it was a wonderful time.
It's like going to camp, right? Stratford? Everybody I talk to, it's like you just pick up your life from Toronto or wherever
and
you have
go.
To be. And
this was during Michael Langham's time.
Right.
Again, things were different. Things are a bit smaller. The enterprise was not as huge as it is now.
Sure.
I don't think it was quite as commercial. Company was smaller. We didn't have big musical productions. It was really a Shakespearean festival. But again, very important. And I worked with, you know, with wonderful people. And I remember one incident. I was understudying. Yeah, Franny Hyland. That's right.
All right.
Anyway, she was like size one.
Okay.
And I wasn't size one. And I was her understudy. And very shortly in the season, before we had a chance to have any understudy rehearsals, I think she had a nerve attack or something. She lost her voice, and she was prone to this. She'd get laryngitis because of nerves. So I had to perform her role without any rehearsals. Zoe Caldwell
was in
the production.
Talk about nerves.
And Alan Bates was in the production. And, of course, wonderful Butch Blake, Mervyn Blake. And they were so kind to me because I knew all the lines, thankfully. But they kind of, they pulled me and they pushed me across the stage to make sure, you know, I would be in the proper place and would be in the light and everything. And we're just so lovely. There's a generosity really in the theater that is real.
I think it's real if you're part of that generosity, if you're generous yourself.
Well,
you know, it needs to be sort of reciprocal.
Well, yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. But I can't see anyone who isn't generous wanting to be in the theater because you are so dependent on everybody with you. Your performance is only as good as the weakest link in the, you know, in the thing.
And it is a listening game.
It is.
There are some
performers who really think that, well, you know, they want to be the big shot and the big star, and so they'll they'll kind of negate the other performers. But I don't understand that because, well, I just don't understand that because it's an ensemble. And we at the theater school, we were trained in ensemble acting. That was the basis of the thing.
Right.
Is that you work together as a team. You're not there to become an actor, you know, kind of star and out there on your own doing your own thing. You were there to learn how to work with other
people.
But
I think sometimes organically you will suddenly see that somebody has this tremendous talent, and that's maybe what starts to create nervousness and second guessing yourself, because that can create divisions, I guess, when you're looking at
Well, there are divisions. There are divisions, but there are some people who maybe shouldn't be in the theater. Like there are, you know, there are classifications, as there are in every profession,
right,
as to who's okay at their job and who's, well, you know, all right, and then someone who's, yeah, solid, and then there are other people who are really kind of brilliant,
right,
and thrilling to watch and always interesting. So if you're lucky.
It's Art at the End of the World. My name is Mark Wigmore. We'll return with Marilyn Lightstone in moments. You're listening to the Zoomer Podcast Network. You are with Art at the End of the World on the Zoomer Podcast Network. We return to my conversation with a voice you know very well from the New Classical FM, Marilyn Lightstone.
Something just sort of reviewing your TV and film career is that I really feel like every time that you were performing, you were in the character. I really believed that you were this person. And that,
oh, that's a nice thing to say.
So often I don't see that. And just going through, you know, when you're putting something like this together and you're studying, you know, you on Cagney and Lacey and you in your various films, and you get to put it all together and see it all at once, it started to be a real theme for me that you were completely believable in every character.
Well, I just love acting.
Yeah.
You know, I love acting. I don't get to do nearly as much of it as I really would like to.
Sure.
It's challenging and fun.
It is fun. Do you look back at that theater career and then what turned into film and TV as just this heady time in your life, like the best time in your life, or do you think of it now as
every time is the best time?
Yeah.
No, I kind of, whatever I'm into at the moment is the end involves me, and I say it's a lot as long as it's work that involves my mind and my heart, you know, my emotions and my disciplines, you know, that I've acquired through the years. I'm happy. No, it's whatever is of the moment. If I'm painting, that's what I'm into. If
right.
I'm, you know, acting, that's what I'm into. Or
I like that type of artistry. Somebody like, you know, I've interviewed Jane Sibbery a couple times, and it's always fascinating to me to see there was this point in her career where there was a lot of light on her, but that doesn't, it's sort of meaningless, you know, in the greater scope of her artistic, what she wants to do, you know, and that's very special. I think if you have that internally, it's always going to be, keep you solid in this business.
We do our best.
Yeah, we do our best. There was this period, though, and we all mentioned it already in Praise of Older Women, everything you did with Anne of Green Gables, which, by the way, you've got a huge, like, a wiki fandom page that's all about you and your character on Rodin, Avonlea and Anne of Green Gables, and seeing you in King of Kensington and so on. And often I'm noticing, even just reviewing, looking at King and Kensington, you're often this object of desire. And you did it well. And you do it well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That is
fellas,
so funny.
The fellas are chasing you. There was some projects
I never thought of it like that.
Yeah.
But, all right. I always think of it as character roles.
So. Right. That was just they put the script in front of me and
go.
I did what they said. But no, so you've never thought of it as like that.
No, not really.
That was a thing for a while.
No, not really. When I think of In Praise of Older Women, you know, I keep of the role that I was playing. It wasn't that she was sexy, but that she was sneaky. She was, you know, she was betraying her best friend, you know, with her young boyfriend. So
she was.
Exactly.
And she was scolding him for being sneaky, but she was sneaky too.
That's right.
And on King of Kensington, which was a lot of fun to rewatch that, and always fun to watch King of Kensington, but you're the old girlfriend who...
That's right.
Who comes back.
Yes, who does have an eye on Al's character. Yes.
That's right.
About it, but
So you'll excuse me as I went through the material and started to make these connections. Tell me about the Anne of Green Gables experience, because I think there's such still this huge fandom around it. You worked out in PEI. You then are part of these two the film and as well the television series. I think to this day that's where so many people are going to place
it. It's quite fascinating to me, actually, and it's delightful to me too, because it was a wonderful project and a worthwhile, heartwarming, heartfelt, feel good, funny. You know, all the good things that you can say about it are all true.
Slightly more conservative character than what we were just talking about.
A more conservative character. But yeah. I like Miss Stacy a lot. I probably think Miss Stacy is probably much more akin to, you know, to me than all the sexy characters.
Right.
But it's been very touching to me that somehow the role of that teacher has struck a chord with people. She's the teacher everyone wanted to have, would have liked to have had, and either did have or didn't have and wanted to.
Did you have a teacher like that?
Not exactly. No one quite as influential in my life, but there were teachers that I respected highly, like Mrs. Sherman I told you about, but Leah Sherman, my art teacher.
I think it's something to do with the intimacy of PEI in that era, too, right?
Our teachers weren't quite, you know, as close to. They didn't know our families. They didn't know our day-to-day life.
Sure.
First of all, filming on location, you know, outdoors, all the outdoor stuff was done, you know, in this village with no, you know, all fronts, you know, all the exteriors with nothing inside.
Oh, yeah, that routine.
And it was always great going up. I think it's Vaughan Township somewhere that we were.
Okay.
And it was always lovely going there and being in the country. But somehow, given the fact that there were so many children, everyone kind of behaved as if they were in loco parentis, you know. The children were excellent at their job and very hardworking and part of the team. But we all felt as grown-ups that we had to protect the children and be there for the kids and help the kids. And that not only the actors, but the crew.
Yeah.
It was a very good feeling. Also knowing that you're, you know, working on a project that everybody loves, it always makes you feel good.
Well, it was absolutely beloved, as, you know, the fact that they're still making series about that character and about that book.
Yes.
It's incredible.
And I'm still getting letters from people who have watched the series kind of overseas. I have the hugest amount of people following me on Instagram from Iran, for exactly.
Wow.
Because Anne was very big there. Well, being an innocent, you know, kind of family story, it could be safely sold to countries in which the laws about things like nudity and sexuality were very, very strict. So Anne passed all those tests with flying colors in all these countries where this sort of thing was prohibited. And I get letters from Russia, but lots from the Middle East.
Iran is fascinating. You have to imagine the cultural, I mean, maybe like you're saying, the cultural differences aren't that great because it is a conservative.
Very conservative milieu and historical.
Place in the world. But at the same time, just the imagery is very different.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
I do want to bring up the voice work, because you did talk about how much you love radio plays. And as I started to look through your credits, I was amazed at how many of these particular projects I had seen and I had probably listened to. I'm pretty sure I can place your voice in heavy metal, for example. I remember.
That to me is so hysterical. You recorded that when I was in Los Angeles, and they were using whatever Canadian actors were, you know, kind of in Los Angeles, I guess. And I had no idea that it was going to be this kind of
cult,
I don't know,
classic.
Kind of a sexy cult classic.
It sure is.
I had no idea. I don't think I've ever seen it, actually.
You haven't?
No, I don't think so.
It has a great soundtrack, too. Donald Fagen from Steely Dan is on it. There's little vignettes. It's all different cartoons by different, you know, animators. And yeah, there's your voice.
Yes.
And I can hear it. And then I'm looking here, Scooby-Doo, GoBots, The Real Ghostbusters, and Heathcliff. I saw all those, and it's all your voice.
Yes.
It's incredible.
Well, you know, this whole world of people who watch these things online somewhere. There's a guy who is a big Heathcliff fan.
Right.
Who has sort of become an Instagram follower, and he keeps sending me things about Heathcliff.
Right.
And little cartoons.
He imagines you're just a massive Heathcliff fan, too.
I have no idea. I mean,
was that often the case? You would be handed a script and you'd say, well, I don't really know what this is, but.
Well, it was usually pretty obvious, actually. Right. It really was with Heathcliff. And they were all such fun. The thing with Heathcliff and Dennis the Menace, too, that was done by a company working on a Canadian contract in L.A. So we had all these Canadians working this team. But we were such a team that we never even rehearsed. We just did it kind of cold. But it's such amazing training for anyone who wants to be, you know, an actor or an actress.
Yeah.
Is that you instantly have to come up with an outrageous character and an outrageous voice and reading, like without thinking too much. There's no scratching your navel or thinking about your motivation, you know, or your history or whatever. You just have to do it like fast.
Uh-huh.
And it's tremendous training and such a reliance on the other people, you know, that you're working with, you know. But they were all so good, you know. These people, well, the people in L.A., the voice business, they're pretty great. I wonder sometimes now because what happened to all those people that I worked with who were primarily voice people?
Right.
And they made very handsome incomes because the residual situation in the United States is very different from our situation here in Canada.
Sure.
You can make a lot of money. I still get residuals like for 14 cents, you know, for something I did like 20 years ago.
Just stack those up and save them for a rainy day.
Yeah. But there were people who, you know, who were stars in that element. And then suddenly this whole thing of hiring movie stars, you know, to be the leads and voice films and whatnot. And I wonder what happened to my old buddies, you know, who were so good at what they did.
Well, it's true. If you watch just about any animated feature now, I can't remember the last time it wasn't a Hollywood star,
yeah,
you know, voicing it.
That's right. I think it's kind of a shame.
It is kind of a shame. It's fun sometimes.
Uh-huh.
If it's somebody, you know, it's fun to hear Bill Murray or something, but not all the time. Yeah. Like, it would be nice to just hear some other talent.
That's right.
Out there.
And when someone, you know, kind of hires you and says, I want you to sound like such and such. And that's a big no-no. Like, don't.
Yeah.
So to me, waving the red flag in front of me, I'm not happy with that at all. If you want me to sound like me and my various iterations of me, fine. But don't ask me to, you know, to come on and sound like another actress. It makes me very cross.
Your voice has served you well.
You have
a great voice.
I enjoy it. I enjoy doing voice work. Well, it's such a powerful instrument, isn't it, Mark?
I have mixed feelings about, you know, I have to work a lot with my own voice because I edit all my own material all the time. How do you feel about hearing you?
I've gotten used to it. You know,
yeah, me too.
At first, just like when people first heard themselves on a tape recorder. I mean, that doesn't happen probably so much now because we're being taped all over the place.
Big difference. You hear it on your phone or something.
It is.
Yeah.
But at one time, you know, nobody taped their voice. Nobody knew what they sounded like. And when they did, they were always shocked and horrified.
Yeah.
But you get over that. You get over that. And it's a tool. It's wonderful the things that you can do just with your voice. I mean, you could sound very serious and you could sound pained and you can sound happy and you can sound all those things just...
One of your
by thinking it.
Great tones is, to me, is like refreshing and effervescent. I think you do it. Where I really noticed it was when you did the Bravo Network.
Oh, yes.
And I remember thinking, who is this woman who can enunciate and pronounce so perfectly? And it was such a great, refreshing change from all the other voiceover that I was hearing on other channels. Specifically, you know, often a channel will have a voice. And they take you through it and so on. And yours really cut through.
Well, I hope that is a good thing cutting through.
Oh, no, absolutely.
I hear some of the voices now actually quite, this is an age thing, I guess. But it seems that the style of voices is as much open to change as everything else in the world.
Sure.
And I find the changes in the last couple of generations, particularly in female voices, I don't get it at all. I find listening to mature women who sound like they were like they're 12 years old very upsetting to me. And I hear voices like that reading the news, and I said, how can anyone take a voice like that seriously?
That's
it's kind of
point.
Up here and kind of up there,
right.
And kind of like it's like mad gerbils and kind of a. And I'm kind of appalled, and I don't get it.
Around my house, we sometimes say, "Too bad about the voice on that." That person, or too bad.
Really?
You know, great guy, but that voice.
But though there's no awareness. There's
right.
No awareness that, I don't know about you, but when I meet someone for the first time, okay, you can, you know, you control the way you look, how you're dressed, you know, your shoes are shiny, you've got a good haircut, your whatever. But as soon as you open your mouth, you just give everything away about you. And if I find someone who sounds like this, I mean, there's no way I'm going to trust that person to do anything serious in my life. I just won't.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to sound like you're 12, I'm sorry.
To me, I mean, it felt like there was a line from Bravo to what you do on Nocturne to a certain degree. Like there was a lot of similarities in how you wanted to present.
I guess because in both cases, you want to be taken seriously, mm-hmm. and yet you do want to be clear, and you do not want to confuse anyone, and you do want to sound as pleasing to the ear as you can be. And that's another thing, too, the idea that you don't have to think about being pleasing to the ear. Now, I don't modulate my voice to be pleasing to the ear.
Right.
But the fact is, if your voice is not pleasing to the ear, there are things you can do about it. I sometimes think that if there was nothing else I wanted to do in this world, if we want to see women in politics and high positions, mm-hmm. I would like to train them, personally train them in terms of how the voice work. Because sometimes I see women stand up and I know their position in the world, but I hear them talk. And again, they sound like they're 12. And I cannot have any faith in what they say because of the way they say it. So all you women out there, anyone listening, don't think your voice is just something that you have and you can do nothing about. There's such easy ways, really, to modulate your voice and to change it. And certainly, you know, as a theater school, you know, for some people, they had to work very hard at changing. But their voices were either too high-pitched or they're too nasal or they're too whatever. They were too something. And they worked extremely hard to make their voices so that they could function as instruments of art and communication.
I still think about it every day with every broadcast. I'm sure you go through it too, where you're refining and you're remembering and you're, what is the code I need to follow?
A certain feeling, yeah. I know, certainly in front of a microphone.
Yeah.
There's a certain kind of place that I know that I'm comfortable, and I'd like to know that the microphone is picking that up and I'm making it easy for them.
And it is a performance to some degree.
It is.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's what you're doing.
Well, it's communication.
Yeah.
I mean, performance is communication.
Sure.
But all, you know, I mean, what we're doing now is communication. And
right.
Be prepared to do it well. And again, are they teaching that in schools? Or are they giving any guidance? I really don't know. I don't know what's happening.
It doesn't seem like
together. It. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like.
Like, oh my like, goodness, that's a tough
you
one.
You deal with that a lot when you're interviewing people?
I find it's either the tap is completely running and I know that I've got a huge editing job in front of me. You either are that person or you aren't.
I thought it was just the women. I thought it was just the females.
Oh, no.
But no, it's not. It's the guys, too, because I've been keeping my ears open.
Yeah.
And I don't understand, because to me, communication, I mean, everywhere you look, there's schools of communication, it's like a big thing, communication. Oh. But somehow I think we're failing at communication with all this emphasis on communication. We are not giving people the tools they need to communicate.
Conversation doesn't seem to be a thing that people even do as
That's
much.
Right.
We don't talk on the telephone much anymore, a lot of us. So I do think there's a huge degradation that's happening. But maybe that will be for people like you and I, that we will go on with our lives and we'll feel bad about how the young people are communicating. And
well, you know,
one
thing I really think I've finally learned at this time in my life, there is a zeitgeist in the world, a certain kind of forces at play. And you can try to fight it, whatever. But sometimes they're just... It's a fight you can't win. So just, you know, proceed doing the stuff that you know you like to do and that you feel that has worth and forget about the rest of it. You know, not try to be au courant because au courant might not be what you want to be.
The book, when did you decide, okay, because I struggle with this all the time. People say, you should write something, you know, I think you could do it. But I think there has to be a great personal belief.
Yes.
That you'll be able to sit down day after day and crank out a tale and know that you have those characters realized and that you have the language to tell that story.
I think that the desire, first of all, is the important thing, to really want to do it. And the reason why I wanted so much to do it was, you know, in my life as a young actress and meeting audiences and talking to audiences after a performance, is that these are people who were theater goers and love the theater, love going to the theater. But they didn't know anything about acting. They knew about actors, but only in terms of film act. They knew about the scandals, and they knew about the huge salaries, and they knew about the drunkenness and punching photographers. They knew all the silly stuff. But in terms of knowing...
The craft.
You know, what actors do when they come in to go to work,
right.
How they prepare to get up on the stage, they knew nothing. And these are people who attend the theater, yet for some who never go, well, what happens? How does this happen, this performance on the stage?
Right. It is a bit of a magic trick.
It is a bit of a, and it should look like a magic trick, but, you know, a lot of hard preparation goes into the magic trick and training to do the magic trick. So I thought, well, after hearing the same questions over and over again and realizing that these very devoted theater audiences knew nothing about how acting happens, I thought I would like to write a book about it.
And tell that story.
The best way to do it would be to talk about, you know, how actors train.
How was that process for you?
It was a lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed it.
You did?
Yes. Oh, I did. I really, I love writing. You have to be psyched and up, you know.
Discipline.
To get there. And discipline. Yeah. I set aside time at the time and when I had the time to do it. But I did...
Did you hole away in an office or go somewhere nice?
I did. No, I was just, you know, I was living in New York at the time.
Okay.
And I'd left Tamara, the production that I was in New York, which I'd been in for, well, a year and a half. And I decided I'm just going to take the time now to finish this because it had lingered for a number of years. I hate unfinished things. I like finishing what I start.
I'm with you on that very much. And even you must have gone through all the things, though, that the author goes through, which is the doubt and maybe I should just stop this or...
No.
No. You just felt...
No, once I decided... No, the thing is, once I just... It takes me a long time to get to the point and say, yes, I'm going to do this. That's the thing. But if I finally say I'm going to do this, I have to finish it. I can't think of too many things where I start something and then just leave it in the middle because it's like not proven to be what I thought it was going to be.
That's an incredible high wire act, and I admire it greatly. Yeah. I think putting the effort to do that and to realize the characters and to know the story you want to tell, and I guess that's part of it, you know, is really having a firm understanding of what it is you want to say.
Exactly, and that's my problem at the moment, because I would like to write another book, but I don't know what to write about. There seems to be nothing that compels me as strongly as this, you know, this first idea. But, you know, I love books, you see. I love books. And, I spend a lot of my time reading. And when I read good writing, I'm so thrilled by it. And, like, how... And sometimes when I read a novel that's so complex but so beautifully put together, and I'm fascinated. Like, how did they do that?
Oh, no.
How did they... can envision that? How did all that come together? And, you know...
That's what paralyzes me. I look at that... trickery. I look at that skill. I look at that.
But you don't know until you start, Mark. You have to start and struggle with it. Otherwise, you'll never know how you get out of it if you don't get into it in the first place.
Right. There's a picture I saw of you cooking for Moses.
Oh,
and
gosh.
It says that you really enjoy cooking for Moses.
I did enjoy cooking for Moses. And I still do like preparing food for him. But I'm now on a non-gluten, non-sugar, non-dairy situation. My desire to cook has really kind of almost vanished.
It changes, right?
But
the diet world we live in now?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. But, you know, cooking is just like, is it like acting to me? Or like making, I made stuff up. I wasn't very good about following recipes.
You're not as sure about the cooking world as you are about your author life.
No, not at all. And at this point, you know, the less emphasis there is on food in my life, sort of the easier it is for me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Just in the sense that because you are dealing with dietary restrictions, and so it's just...
It is. It is. And I find I'm trying to sort of find a reason to be interested in cooking the way I'm supposed to be cooking.
I know. I feel the exact same way. I don't have it.
No, I like, you know, lots of salt and lots of hot sauce and lots of honey and lots, you know... And lots of and sugar and maple syrup and, you know, all the things.
When the canvas is wide open and you have all the paints... Yeah. I mean, that's a great feeling.
Exactly.
We don't live in that world anymore, it seems.
No. But it has been so good for me, you know, this new diet that I'm compelled to follow it.
I hear that's it. How it works. Yeah.
It is.
Very nice.
I can't deny that.
I'll ask because you two have been together for years. It feels like it's been a great back and forth of a meeting of the minds. You inspire each other to go on these artistic adventures.
Well, I don't know if I ever inspire Moses, but Moses, again, like my parents, I've been doubly blessed.
Right.
Because, again, females, we are subject to what our parents want for us, and we are also very much subject to what our partners in life want for us, or how they see us and how they envision us. So on the one hand, I had my parents, you know, who just gave me such liberty to be who I was, and to do what I wanted to do. And Moses is the same way. If I want to paint, travel, write, whatever, he will do everything possible to help me make sure that becomes a reality. And that is a total blessing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can love someone dearly, but still hold them down,
yeah,
keep them back. Say, well, I don't think you should do that, or let's go do something else instead. Or I have not had to follow a lot of the domestic demands, really, that a lot of women have. And that is something still that we're talking about in this new era of promoting women in the arts and the profession, that women still are, by and large, they're mothers. You know, they're often mothers or daughters, or they have family roles to fulfill, and no one to help them do it, or not the money to get the help to do it. And I've been, you know, liberated from all that by a very generous and understanding partner.
I mean, there's always going to be that other thing in life. I more or less live child-free. I've made some decisions along that time, designed my life as best I could to live that life. I do sometimes look on the other side of it and think, I wonder what that would have been like.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. You can't help but do that. That's human, a human thing. The life not lived.
Right. But you seem very pleased with the decisions you've made and the life you've lived.
Well, you know, it would be so foolish not to be, because it's like suicidal. It's committing a suicide in reverse, kind of going back. I knew enough actresses who were moms to know that this is not an easy thing. Maybe all the professions, but maybe law is just as demanding of women, you know, in terms of relationships with family. Actresses became moms. It's very tough to fulfill both roles.
It really is.
And
somebody's going to pay.
Somebody's going to pay. It hasn't been, you know, it's okay for the parents, but it's harder for
you,
the children.
Yeah, you or the kid are going to pay.
Exactly, you know. But I look at little children and say, wouldn't it be nice to have some grandchildren, you know, just because they're just so sweet and
they
so cute.
They are so sweet.
And they're lovely. I mean, the children are just beautiful, and I enjoy watching them. And
what is a day for Marilyn Lightstone?
Oh, it varies. I spend a lot of time goofing off.
I want to goof off.
And I read the Post and the Globe every morning.
Okay.
Because I don't watch the news on television.
Hot cup of sadness every morning.
Well, you know, I feel I should really know what's going on if I intend to have an opinion, which I usually do. Typical day, it all depends what I'm doing. And as I say, I'll have kind of little love affairs with something that'll happen. So it'll either be the writing of the book, and then I'll have one kind of thing. Or if I'm painting and working an art thing, it'll be another kind of whole set altogether. If I'm working on Hit Parade, you know, kind of, you know, here in the studio or doing voice, it all depends really what the demands of the day are.
Are you a person who meanders through that work throughout the day, or do you sit down and say, okay, I'm going to put in 90 minutes on this?
No, I'm a meanderer.
I'm a meanderer too.
And it's kind of hard to sort of sit down and get yourself going at certain times because you're busy meandering on something else.
I find sometimes I have to go do something else so that I can continue the work of the first thing. Like, I need to take a mental break so I can come back to it.
Well, I'm weak. I always find an excuse to sort of, you know, to goof off if I want to. Saying, well, I'll get through this and then I'll be able to focus more fully, you know, on whatever.
Well, I think about the films, the television, the voice work, the photography, the book, all the different, obviously your all-time classic Hit Parade, being on Nocturne every night. It's an incredible arc of a career and an incredible life and an incredible contribution to the arts. So thank you for all you've done.
You're very good for saying that, Mark. But I'll say, if find something you love to do and you'll never work a day in your life. And I feel that really what happened to me. I found something I love to do and I don't work. I just do stuff I love to do.
Well, that was a real treat, getting a chance to speak with Marilyn Lightstone. Love talking to her. Nocturne is on the new Classical FM, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time nightly. You can watch her sing-along TV show, Your All-Time Classic Hit Parade, Friday nights at 8:30 p.m., also Eastern Standard Time on Vision TV. And if you would like to learn more about her career and see some great video clips of her on different TV shows and films over the years, might I suggest MarilynLightstone.com. I also want to thank our sponsors today, Red Eye Media and Crow's Theater. Go see Carly Street, currently on stage with Grounded, crowstheater.com for timing and tickets. Thank you for listening. We are back on Thursday with another edition of our remix series, my 2019 interview with artist and media personality and provocateur, Sookyun Lee. You can always listen to episodes at classicalfm.ca, iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud, artattheendoftheworld.com, and you can find me on social media, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop me a line. We'll speak to you Thursday and for as long as we can.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.